From the Mode Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, movie theater owners hope a new batch of movies will get you to stop streaming at home and hit the multiplex. Then comedian Hasan Minhaj just won a Peabody Award for his deeply personal Netflix special, Homecoming King.
I feel like I'm part of this generation of people who look slightly different or may have slightly different names, but we're adding these amazing ideas to America.
And comedian Wyatt Cenac has a new late-night show looking at social issues that aren't that funny, like policing in America. All that and more after this. Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. Summer movie season is just around the corner. Get ready for more Deadpool, dinosaurs, Avengers, and an all-female Oceans movie with a cast that includes Sandra Bullock, Mindy Kaling, Cate Blanchett, and Rihanna.
So you want to hit a jewelry store?
Not exactly.
A diamond mine.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Or what? The Met.
And movie theater owners hope films like Ocean's 8 will bring in a lot of money at the box office. After all, you can't stream it yet. Streaming, it's the bane to theater owners' very existence. A recent report shows that streaming subscriptions are up in the United States, while movie theater attendance is down to the lowest level in 23 years. But when I spoke with John Fithian, the head of the trade organization that reps movie theater chains, he reframed that statistic.
Well, I'll react to that in a couple ways. I mean, one is to understand in the last 10 years, ticket sales have gone up in four of those, down in five, and even in one. So it's a relatively stable market in terms of ticket sales. It's not a growth market like it is overseas, but it's relatively stable. And the other thing I would say is the experience itself is changing for the better. Right, it's becoming a higher-end experience. And so you can have a business model with attendance numbers that are relatively stable but not growing very much that is still a growth model because the experience and therefore the price tag people are willing to pay for that experience grows. And through innovations like digital sound and projection, through high-end food and beverage service, often alcohol service, luxury recliners, and many other innovations, the cinema experience today in America and now coming around the world is nothing compared to what it was 5 or 10 years ago. And our patrons appreciate that, and they're willing to pay more for it.
The last time we had you on the show was in 2015, and that year the major studios released 100 movies. And you felt then that that wasn't really enough. This past year, they released just 86 films, so 14 fewer than the last time we talked to you. What does that do to your side of the business?
While it's true that the major studios are reducing their slates, what they're doing, you know, led by Disney, is making fewer movies but making gigantic movies. And we desperately need those blockbusters. We've had, you know, 2017 we had more big blockbusters making more money than ever before. At the same time, though, we also need the mid and small budget movies. And we are encouraged to see other players stepping into that void, that reduction left by the major studios to make those mid-budget and smaller budget movies. We operate every month of the year, and then we need good movies every month of the year. We are really encouraged by things like Black Panther coming out in February. We have a gigantic draw of an audience in a time when the theaters are usually slow with a majority minority cast for the first time in a blockbuster ever. That's a real promising sign. This summer looks to be the summer of female leads or themes that appeal to females. Overboard, Tully, Life of the Party, Breaking In, Book Club, Ocean's 8, Incredibles 2. I mean, the list just goes on of movies that are predominantly led by women or that appeal to female audiences. So we're excited about that form of diversity in our programming as well.
Do you think that that segment of the audience has been underserved? I mean, obviously the nation is about 50% female, 50% male, but is it your feeling and your theater owner's feeling that there hasn't been enough content that is made for and features women in prominent roles?
Absolutely. People starring in and making movies should reflect the diversity of the audiences that want to go see them. And for years, we've decried the fact that Hollywood, in terms of who makes the decisions about movies, who produces and directs movies, and who stars in movies, has been overwhelmingly white male, right? And our audience is 52-53% female and growing in terms of racial and ethnic diversity. In fact, Hispanic Americans are the most frequent moviegoers here in this country, and of course the movie industry is a global business now. And so when you see movies like the Fast and Furious series with a cast that reflects what the world looks like, it's no great surprise that those movies do a tremendous amount of business.
I want to ask you about experience and pricing. If I'm going to take a long flight on an airplane, I'm going to pay a little bit more to fly on United and Economy Plus. It's going to be a better experience than, say, Spirit, where I have to pay extra for a bottle of water. So why should I pay the same amount of money to see some bad Nicolas Cage movie as the next Christopher Nolan masterpiece?
It's a really good question, John. And many of our members are looking at dynamic pricing in many different respects. The seats within the auditorium, just like the seats on an airplane. Some people prefer some seats over others. The supply and demand curve, as you get closer to a movie that's selling out should probably have a higher price point than a movie that's not. Perhaps the most controversial, if you will, is to decide ahead of time which movies are going to be good and which movies aren't, and to charge differently for them, because that's kind of prejudging the magic in the art form, and we really want our patrons to decide that, not us.
Let me ask you this last question. We have talked on our show recently about MoviePass and about its model of paying $10 a month to see as many as one movie a day. There's certainly been some pushback from theater chains like AMC. Does NATO have a position on MoviePass?
Well, first, you know, again, as a trade association, it's not appropriate for us to take a position. So I won't opine on MoviePass specifically. But I'll say that there are several subscription services in the works domestically, and there are subscription services that have been in place for years overseas, in Europe, for example. They can work if they're structured correctly.
John Fithian is the president of the National Association of Theater Owners. John, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having me, John.
Comedian Wyatt Cenac is back on TV with a new late-night show called Problem Areas. The second episode airs tonight on HBO at 11:30.
You know, I'd like to talk about something, and it's actually something we're going to spend all 10 episodes on. I want to talk about policing in America. Wait, don't go. Look, I know what you're thinking. Black guy talking policing? No, thank you. I'll watch Zootopia, which, coincidentally, also about policing.
In the show, Cenac both hosts and reports on issues from around the country, and those pieces are longer and far more serious than the field reports that he filed as a correspondent on The Daily Show.
This is my propeller beanie.
But why? What?
I'm in Florida, John. This is the least threatening item of clothing I own.
And one of the executive producers on Cenac's new show is another Daily Show alumnus, and that is John Oliver. Unlike Oliver's HBO show, Cenac does not have a studio audience. He doesn't sit behind a desk either. It's more of a throwback to 1970s-style public affairs shows. His home base is a wood-paneled sort of den where his only colleagues are Siri and Alexa.
I mean, Siri's been listening to me all night, and she hasn't said
Hey, Alexa's been pretty quiet.
Way to throw me under the bus.
I reached Cenac last night in his Brooklyn offices to discuss Problem Areas, and it wasn't just any other night for Cenac. First, happy birthday.
Thank you very much.
And at 6:30, you're in your office on the night of your birthday. Doesn't sound like too much fun.
I would disagree. I get to make a show that is a weird thing that started out in my brain, that it's maybe the best birthday gift I could ask for.
Well, what was the weird thing? What was that spark of an idea when you first started thinking about what this show could be?
I was inspired by old public affairs type of shows. They usually would come on like a Saturday or Sunday at noon before a football game or something like that. So thinking about those shows, I think what was interesting about those shows to me was they would talk about a societal issue or talk about something in society that people are talking about nationally, but look at the localized approach to dealing with it or to addressing it. The problems that exist in one city don't necessarily exist the same way in another city. You know, with something like policing, for instance, you know, the city of New York has spent almost $1 billion on a training facility. That's not a model that translates to a smaller city that only has a police force of 20 people.
I want to talk a little bit more about training because that's a focus on the first episode of your series. We're going to play a clip from Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman. He teaches something called killology. Let's hear a little clip from what killology is on your show.
Now, killology is a made-up term for a made-up scientific discipline made up by a guy who's never actually killed anybody. You know, because the best experts are the ones with no experience.
If you properly prepare yourself, killing is just not that big a deal. LAPD brought me out to do their in-service day for the detectives. A crusty old LAPD detective came up. She said, "Colonel, you're the first one in 20 years to tell me it's okay to not feel bad about killing those guys."
There's lots to talk about here. What was your impetus in illustrating what killology is and what this guy is advocating?
You know, it's very easy in a national conversation to say, after a tragedy, these officers need more training, they need more training, they need better training. And the reality is, there are so many types of training that exist for police officers, and we're maybe not having the conversation about the types of training that these officers are getting and what the effects of that type of training is as a society. And by a city to city accounting, we don't have those stats. You could probably find more about the types of training that athletes go through in the off season on your favorite sports team with a simple Google search than you could for what your officer's going through, or even being able to say before your officers go through something, to say, "Oh, okay, maybe don't send the officers to the guy who has an organization that he's calling the Killology Research Group."
We're talking with Wyatt Cenac about his new series, Problem Areas. The other thing you talk about is this idea on a local level of character-based hiring, that if you are looking for people who are going to interact with the community as law enforcement officers, maybe you want people who have a disposition to treat those people in a certain way, as opposed to this warrior versus enemy mentality. And I'm wondering, as you're kind of working on the series, if you start encountering solutions that maybe didn't even occur to you that might be emulated by other people.
For sure. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and say that I know everything about policing and policing in this country. There are over 17,000 different police agencies in the United States, and they all go about things a different way. There's obviously overlap between a lot of them. A lot of different police officers will say, you see people on their worst days in the job of a police officer. And I think for anyone who comes into contact with a police officer, you hope that they treat you with the dignity and respect of someone who is experiencing their worst possible day and the empathy that would follow with that.
You are both the host and a reporter, and also in this show, you also share some personal stories that are very meaningful and important, I think, for everybody here. In the second episode, you talk about something that happened to you when you were a younger man at a mall.
When I was 19 years old, I got arrested for inciting a riot because I told a mall cop off because my car had been broken into and he wouldn't file a report about it. And then he arrested me for inciting a riot, which didn't seem cool. And I got banned from the mall that I worked at.
Wow.
Yeah. To me, I guess sharing that was, this is my investment in this. This is why this story is interesting to me, because, yeah, I've had friends who've been arrested. I've had family members who've been arrested. These are stories that touch a lot of people. And so on some level, perhaps understanding it is also recognizing how close it is to everybody.
A lot of people certainly know what happened to Philando Castile, and they've seen video, they've thought about it, they've read about it. What is it like when you actually go to Minnesota, where Philando Castile was killed?
I feel like the training scared them into being scared.
Yeah.
You know, especially when you look at, like, Philando. Yanez was scared when he got to the window. He was shaken.
Yeah.
What was going on in your mind? And who shaped that mind to think like that?
For me, what was interesting and compelling about going there is to see a story that had gotten so much attention nationally, and to see that video footage of his girlfriend and her daughter, it really affected a lot of people, myself included.
Mom, please help me, because I'm just screaming because I don't want you to get shot.
Okay, give me a kiss.
I wish this town was safer. I don't want it to be like this anymore.
When you see something like that, in that moment, we're all in shock. And what I found compelling was, how does an entire city move forward? Not just the citizens, but the legislators and law enforcement themselves. What does moving forward look like when the agency that has been entrusted with the safety and the security of its own citizens has taken the life of one of those citizens?
The second episode of Problem Areas is running tonight. What's your pitch to people to tune in and check it out?
The pitch would be, it will hopefully be more amusing than our conversation. Like I said, I was off the clock. So, no, I think my hope is that if anyone is interested in learning more about policing and just looking at ways that communities and law enforcement are trying to address an issue that seems to be confounding and intractable, that to me would be my pitch for watching the show. And it's got good theme music, if you're a fan of theme music.
Wyatt Cenac, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
And happy birthday.
Thank you.
Coming up, we go from a former Daily Show correspondent to a current Daily Show correspondent. Hasan Minhaj just won a Peabody Award for his Netflix comedy special, Homecoming King. The Peabody Awards are handed out every year to recognize excellence in television, radio, and online media. Among the winners this year is Hasan Minhaj for his Netflix comedy special, Homecoming King. In it, he reflects on his life as an Indian American Muslim kid growing up in the predominantly white city of Davis, California. The 32-year-old is a senior correspondent on The Daily Show, although he plans to exit this summer. Last year, he emceed the White House Correspondents' Dinner, which notably was boycotted by the Trump administration. I spoke with Minhaj about Homecoming King, which he actually recorded in front of an audience in his childhood hometown of Davis, California.
So much of the theme of the show was about identity and growing up, and I wanted to shoot the special in the place where I'm actually talking about those stories, because there's something really powerful in that, and you could feel it in the audience that night.
I would say, as a white guy, one of the most powerful things about your special is being able to understand through specific incidents what it's like to be somebody who looks like you. I want to talk about a girl that you dated when you were young. You call her Bethany Reed. I suspect that's not her real name, but it's a real person. And it's somebody you spent a lot of time with. You decided to take her to the prom.
First love,
And here you are in the show, sneaking out of your house because your parents are probably not going to approve of her as a prom date, and heading over to her house on prom night on your bike. Let's listen.
I put on the JCPenney suit.
Spray on the Michael Jordan cologne, 6 puffs, 1 for each championship. You don't want to overkill it with the MJ cologne. Don't be tacky.
I'm not going to say how this story ends. It doesn't end well, and it's heartbreaking to watch. And it reveals so much about, you know, where we are as a nation and people who think we've moved on and that we're in a post-racial country, they're wrong. And I'm curious about why you felt it was so important to share this story with your audience.
The story that I'm telling in Homecoming King about falling in love, these are things that happen to me that actually happen every day in our backyards and in our communities. The reason why I think that the story is so powerful, it's the first time, and I think we've all experienced this, regardless of race, color, creed, or class, or sexuality. We've all dealt with these doorstep moments where we've put ourselves on the line and we weren't accepted because of something that we can't control. It was the first, we're going to go in a different direction moment where you put your heart on the line and people say, hey, because of variables you can't control, we just have to do something different because, you know, if you're seen with our daughter at prom, we're going to take photos and what are people going to think, you know? And that moment, I think, in my life captured so much, and I think it speaks to a lot of moments that people are having now.
I wonder if there's something unique about the relationship between parents who are immigrants and their children who are comedians and other parents whose children are comedians, because Ali Wong said that when she told her mom, who's from Vietnam, about her Netflix comedy special, her mom said, they show Cheers reruns on there, so what? She was totally, totally unimpressed. Is there a special dynamic about being the child of immigrants and doing comedy that is different from other fields and other comedians whose parents aren't immigrants?
I think the biggest thing that immigrant parents, the reason why they make comments like that is that they've sacrificed everything for their children to be here in the United States. And if you're going to come to the craps table called the American Dream, don't roll or bet on comedian. You can be a nurse. You can be a dentist, an orthodontist, a dermatologist, a cardiologist, an engineer. You can be an incredibly productive member of society in a respected career that has a great deal of longevity. And like, it comes from an immense amount of gratitude. Why are you throwing away this privilege? That's really what their position on it is. And can you honestly blame them?
Let me ask you this last question. You're not alone very narrowly in what you're talking about as a representative in comedy of New Brown America. Kumail Nanjiani is doing amazing stuff. Aziz Ansari is doing amazing stuff. When you think about the people who, I guess, broadly speaking, look a little bit like you, is it important that there's strength in numbers and that you are not alone, but you're working together, even if your jokes are different, representing a new perspective on what this country looks like?
Yeah, I think it is really important because we're adding to this milieu, this tapestry of what the American experience is. You know, and I know that this can be sometimes, I feel it. I get these responses on Twitter. Oh, God, why does everything have to be a race or about identity? To me, it's not about that. It's even bigger than that. It's about adding ideas and perspectives. We're at this crazy turning point for the country. We're fighting. Are we the nativist narrative or are we the immigrant narrative? I feel like I'm part of this generation of people who look slightly different or may have slightly different names, but we're adding these amazing ideas to America. And that, to me, is the narrative I'm fighting for.
Hassan, thanks so much for your time and for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, man. I really appreciate it.
Hassan Minhaj will host the Peabody Awards on May 19th. His comedy special, Homecoming King, which won a Peabody, is available on Netflix. And we close out the week with this. Today brings the sad news that the popular electronic dance DJ and producer Avicii was found dead in the Middle Eastern nation of Oman. Avicii, whose real name is Tim Bergling, produced music for Madonna and Coldplay, and he is one of the world's highest paid DJs. His songs have been streamed more than a billion times on Spotify. The song you're hearing, Wake Me Up, is his collaboration with singer Aloe Black. No reason has been given for his death, but he did retire from touring 2 years ago because of health issues that he said were related to excessive drinking. Avicii was just 28 years old. And that is The Frame for this week. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. We'll see you back here on Monday.